Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Off Track Podcast. It is great to have you here. Thank you for joining us. As always, I am your host, Matt Eshi, and it is great to see this table getting longer and longer. The people that are sitting back, relaxing, and joining us as well. For those of you, a happy Easter to everyone, first and foremost, before we start out, depending on when you're absolutely listening to this one. So happy Easter to all. This week, one of the things we've always wanted to do on the podcast, one of my goals has always been to try at least get somebody from every discipline in track and field onto the podcast. We've had meet managers, we've had coaches, we've had meet promoters, we've had jumpers as well. And so one thing I strive to do, and I'm excited to actually be able to do it, is we got a pole vaulter on this week. Yes, we have a guy that jumps over those crazy high bars. But we have an incredible gentleman in Trey Oates joining us, a Sanford alum. And sit down and take a listen as we discuss how that skateboarder, long hair skateboarder hippie, he will call himself that, got into pole vaulting. The importance of that coach-athlete relationship. He ends up at Sanford University, and he goes into the reasons why he ends up at Sanford and with Coach Rod Tiffin, that incredible program there, and how professional pole vaulter is making ends meet. Sometimes we think these pro athletes have everything rock and rolling, but it is incredible what a lot of these athletes do to put food on the table and to be able to get the poles, transportation, and do everything they need to do. So sit back, relax. This one is so good with Trey Oates. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Off Track Podcast. It is great to have you here. We're going to be switching gears tonight a little bit. This is an interesting one. First and foremost, normally we've got a whole panel on, but with a couple coaches dealing with athletes with COVID, we got some people with birthdays. We got people all over the happy birthday to Scott, of course, one of the first members of the podcast. But we're flipping gears. We're going to jump off the actual track side stuff. We're going to jump to the field. And one thing I've always wanted to do is get a pole vaulter on the podcast, and something I've always been intrigued about and very blessed to have a great mutual friend, Chris Spear, that's been able to put myself and Trey Oates together. Trey, how are we doing tonight?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is going to be fun. Again, as I said, we're kind of flying solo tonight, so it's going to be you and me. So hopefully we enjoy it. And hopefully, ladies and gentlemen, you enjoy the podcast as well. But Trey, I know you're out in Arizona right now. We'll get to what you're doing here in a second. But sometimes I look at it. I remember we in high school, we had a guy that jumped over the bar and jumped over the bar, jumped about 14.6, and I'm going to Division III UW lacrosse. And like, what in the world inspired him to do it? And he said when he was originally doing this and jumped over the bar for the first time, he's like, yeah, the reason I jumped over the bar the first time was because I got to jump off the bleachers inside the basketball arena. I thought it was so cool. So vaulting seemed easy. And I was like, So first off, tell me this. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Ackworth, Georgia, which is just outside. Everybody says Atlanta. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, but I'm outside of Atlanta, basically.
Okay. I appreciate you actually specifying where, because just like somebody up in Chicago, like, oh, I'm from Chicago. Like, no, you're from like Lockport. Yeah, that's 25 minutes away. Like, come on, tell me where you're from. So how do you get into vaulting? How do you get into that kind of stuff? What did you do in high school?
Well, in middle school, I was more of like a skateboarder, BMX, go on snowboard trips, that kind of thing. I didn't actually start like track or any type of like running. I guess I played like soccer and baseball, like t-ball and stuff like that, but I didn't really start any organized sports besides football until freshman year of high school. And I started track as well freshman year. I started both really because my best friend Dylan, I basically like lived with in high school, we'd go to football practice together, and then in the spring we'd go to track practice. And I guess the reason I got started pole vaulting was, again, because of Dylan, my best friend, best man at my wedding. He started vaulting. He went over, and our school was brand new. It was like the second year the school was open, I was a freshman. So the pole vault program was brand new that year, that second year. And he went over, and the coach, took a few kids under his wing. I was doing sprints and hurdles because my dad ran hurdles in college. And he tried to run like post-collegiately, had a bunch of knee issues. So he ended up doing like more long distance stuff and was a pretty good like half marathon and stuff like that. But anyway, so I was trying to do hurdles. And then Dylan, my buddy, after practice, he's like, man, you need to come over to pole vault. We don't do any running and we just get to lay on the pit all the time. And I was like, that sounds awesome, because so far I suck at hurdles. So I ended up going over there, and then all the kids heard about that. So then all the kids came to do pole vault. And then my high school coach, who I'm really close with, Coach David Moffitt, he he decided, he's like, all right, we're not going to have 30 kids over here. So he made up this like gauntlet of like, all right, if you can jump this far into the sand with the pole and you can get over this height, then mm-hmm. you can stay on the team. And there were like five of us that did it. And Dylan didn't make it, but I made it. And that's kind of how I picked it up. And I wasn't like extraordinarily talented at it or anything. I just stuck with it until sophomore year. I quit football and then I was all in on track, and that's when everything kind of took off. So
I'm curious on something. You said jump into the pit past this far with the pole. So were you having to like run down the runway with the pole and then jump, like put it into the sand and then jump it? Explain that to me.
Yeah.
It just sounds foreign.
He basically like, you know, a long jump pit. He drew a line, you know, 10 feet in the sand. And he's like, all right, whoever can propel themselves. He was brand new to coaching. He actually vaulted with Earl Bell, who was, you know, the American record holder at Arkansas State. My coach, He vaulted Arkansas State. Vaulted, I think, like 17.4, 17.6 back in the day. So mm-hmm. he was a good vaulter, but he was brand new to coaching. So he didn't know how to identify, like, you know, which of these 30 kids do I want to keep? So, yeah, he just made up this rudimentary, like, progression of like, all right, if you can jump this far in the sand and you can get over 7 feet, you can stay on the team, you know, as a guy. And his daughter was my age and she was vaulting as well. So that's kind of why he took the volunteer coaching job. He still volunteer coaches at my high school now. And he actually works with me. We call all the time. And I talk to him about his kids. He talks to me about mine, all that kind of stuff. So
definitely, cool. I mean, the high school coach had a vested interest in what was going on, especially because of his daughter being there and wanted to learn as much as could help out.
So definitely.
That helps out. So you quit football, you said, sophomore year. Were you doing any other sports?
No, not in high school besides skateboarding and running around with my friends in the neighborhood. Like, that was it. And I say that I quit football, but I actually got kicked off the team. Because I was writing,
what'd you do?
I was writing a note to my girlfriend in class. She went to a different high school, and I was writing her a note. And I was like, "Man, I don't want to go to football practice. I just want to come hang out with you. Like, blah blah blah. I love you so much." And then my teacher took it up, and she gave it to my football coach, and he brought me in the office. And he's like, "If you don't want to be here, son, then get off the team." And I was like, "Good. I hate this," because I was a running back, and you know, as a pole vaulter, you have to run really upright with high knees. And that is not the recipe for a good running back, because I was just getting like creamed on the football field, just getting smacked around. So I didn't like it. I never played really that much. So once I quit/got kicked off, I was pretty happy.
That seems to be almost something. I mean, being upright and high knees, is that's almost when it comes down to it, you got to have a little bit of that with the vault. You got to have a little bit of that with the jumps and that kind of stuff. Now, you don't need that exact technique, but you've got to be upright when you're actually approaching what you're doing. You start leaning over and you're going to be in trouble no matter what.
Especially in pole vault, because you got all that weight in front of you with the pole. And unless you have the perfect pole drop, the pole is not weightless. And so you do have to have this counterbalance to your run. And as me as a, you know, I wasn't exceptionally tall as a high school kid, but I did run upright, and our football team was like a wishbone offense, run right down the middle. Yep. And I hated that.
Slam it. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So so remind me here. So sophomore year, you quit, then you roll right into track and field. Remind me, did you start, was it your freshman year you started, or was it vaulting?
Yeah, I started vaulting freshman year, and it's really all I did in high school. I mean, like, I ran the 4x1, and I'd run 300 hurdles here and there, run the 200. I was okay at the 200 by my senior year, but pole vault was really my main focus from, like, day one. And different from a lot of kids that I see now, I wasn't ever in, like, a club or anything for track or for pole vault. It was literally just me and my high school coach, and he,
if I can ask before you jump in, when did you graduate high school?
I graduated in 2013.
Okay, so how many clubs are actually around just in general, especially, I know, again, we mentioned earlier, not Atlanta, but from that Atlanta area, which is it's a huge hotbed for track and field. Like, how many clubs are around there to actually do vault? Probably not many, right?
There was only really two. There's still only kind of two in Georgia. When I was coming up, there was Pole Vault Atlanta, which was a really big one that was down in Atlanta. And it was, you know, there was a lot of kids there. It was like 60, 70 kids. And then there was Georgia Pole Vault, which was like located at the high school right next to mine. And I just never like affiliated with either of them. Not because I didn't like them or anything. I enjoyed jumping with my high school coach and we worked out great. Now Georgia Pole Vault's become pretty big. And now it's actually called Flicky Stick Pole Vault, run by Hunter Arnold. One of my teammates actually from high school. But so I didn't really have a club and was sort of just jumping on my own with my coach.
So how, so first time you go over the bar, what was your height?
Oh gosh, I guess 7 feet was my first time. But I don't really remember quite my PRs as it went, but I remember what I jumped after every year. So like after my freshman year, my PR was 10 feet. After my sophomore year was 12.6. So it was like a pretty normal progression, right? Mm-hmm. Then I quit football. And after my junior year, I won state my junior year and jumped 15.6, which was like the highest jump in the state that year. And then my senior year, I jumped 16.4 in my senior season. Mm-hmm. Actually ended up jumping 16.8, excuse me, on a broken foot later that summer. But I won state again as a senior. So it was all... it all came from quitting football is when I kind of like took off my progression, at least.
So you mentioned something. Wait a minute. Well, two things. First off, how the hell did you break your foot? And then be able to jump on it? Did you fracture? That just fracture and it just turned into it? Or what'd you do?
Yeah, that's a whole story in itself. So basically in pole vault, you know, just like in long jump, you want to take off in a very specific location, right? It's not just like willy-nilly. You're running from like a pretty established mark, and my technique in high school was not very great. I was just fast and I could get upside down. I didn't have a really good plant or takeoff, and I'd always take off under, meaning like too close, and kind of leaned back. And when I was doing that my junior and senior year, all that stress taken off under eventually made a stress fracture, which then eventually became a full break. After my high school season, I think it was in like June, like very early June, like June 1st or something like that, I broke my foot, and it was my navicular bone, which, if you know, that's the bone like Michael Jordan, Yao Ming, all those like big basketball players break. And it sucks because that's like one of the most least vascularized bones in your body, really hard to heal.
Takes a long time.
I broke it. Yeah, I broke it, and I went to the ER. They took an x-ray and they're like, oh, it's just an ankle sprain. Because they took the x-rays from the side of my foot. If they would have just taken it from the front, the top.
The top.
Right. And so I was like, okay. So then I'm walking around on it, trying to, you know, whatever. I go about a month, get another x-ray from a specialist. They do the same thing. They're like, oh, ankle sprain. Go another month, right? And this is like right before I'm heading off to college. Get another x-ray. They're like, yep, an ankle sprain. And I'm like, okay. So then... right before I go to college, like I think around early August, like August 1st or 2nd, I get an MRI that tells me it's broken. But in that whole meantime, I'm rehabbing it like an ankle sprain. I'm running around on it, and I end up vaulting a PR on my like broken foot. And the way I describe it to people is like my foot was broken, right? Or my bone was broken. Yep. And I was just rubbing it back and forth until it became two smooth bones and I could like semi-function on it. So It was tough, but once I found out it was broken, it was like I just fell over. I was like, no, I couldn't even stand on it. You know, it was one of those things.
Mental.
But yeah, definitely. So when they told me it was broken from the MRI, they said, you know, this is a big deal because it's considered non-union now. The bones are completely separate from one another. They've like glossed over and healed. So the surgery I had was a pretty invasive one, and my freaking doctor did not have good bedside manner, because me, you know, however old I was, 17 year old in there, I'm just by myself. My parents weren't with me. He was like, he was like Armenian or something, but he was like, you will probably never walk again correctly. And I was like, seriously? And then, you know, started crying, all that. But I somehow made this like miraculous like recovery from that foot thing. And I feel like I have a robotic foot now, because that injury in particular gives me zero problems to this day, except for when I bowl. For some reason, when I bowl, I like really plant my foot like a jab thrower, and that hurts for some reason.
I would go into bowling, but again, I leave that to Michelle Cruz, the bowling coach at UAB. But it's like, do you slam it down? Like, what in the world? I mean, what do you do?
My only goal in bowling is to throw the ball as fast as I can. I go for like the mile per hour record at the bowling alley.
Like, I don't care where it ends up. I just want the thing to fly down. If it jumps from lane to lane, let's rock and roll.
Yeah, I get whatever ball is the smallest that I can fit my fingers in, and then try to throw it 50 miles an hour down the lane. So.
For some people, it's to hit the pins. For some people, it's to bounce back and forth off the gutters. And for everybody else, it's maybe to try and get it to, you know, curve so it jumps from the one lane to the other lane. You never know. And yours is just to knock them all down via fastball. Actually, slow yourself off, just flying through.
I don't think the bowling community has picked up on that technique yet, but it works pretty well. I've bowled like a 220. So,
okay, never mind. We'll go ahead and throw that on the list right there. So did you, okay, so something that actually happened to me, and I'm curious on it, because that's a, I mean, no matter what, because you have to start as your freshman year, you go 7 feet. And if you want to say like, okay, we just have an opening height that you have to hit just to try to get over something in a meet. It's like, okay, did you, and you said you were a little smaller when you were there. And when I remember when I was in high school, like my freshman year, I was 5'4". My sophomore year, I started to get to 5'8", 5'9". And all of a sudden, by the time I was done my sophomore year into my junior year, I was like 6 foot. And so for a distance runner, you're getting longer legs, you cover more distance, you're getting faster, and off you go. Did you grow to be able to make that kind of stuff happen, that those transitions happen? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely grew in high school. I think I ended high school right under 6 feet or right at, no, probably 6 foot. Because I'm like 6'1.5" now, and I don't think I grew too much in college, but I was pretty tall and lanky. I've got really long arms. Like, I think my wingspan to height ratio is like +4 or something like that, or +5. So, the long arms really help in pole vault, just having long levers and long arms, long legs, high center of gravity, terrible for football, but pretty good for pole vaulting. And, you know, just adding a little bit of muscle on that, just from the sheer volume of jumps that I took in high school, you know, got me to where I was.
Nice. Now, were there, with the coaches that, well, with the coach that you were at to volunteer now, what were there some of the takeaways that you took from him, that, you know, some of the lessons that you learned? Was there anything that he instilled in you, maybe work ethics, maybe things along those lines?
He was, so he was probably the first person in my life to like actually sit me down and set concrete goals for something. Cause like, you know, I was a pretty good kid in high school. I didn't like get into a lot of trouble or anything. I got like suspended for, you know, making out with a girl in the bathroom, like that kind of thing, but nothing like crazy.
It seems like everything you've screwed up in or like had consequences right now is with a girl. You know, did you ever tell your wife that, like, man, I mean, I got kicked off the football team for writing notes. I was making out in the bathroom for, you know.
she still holds grudges to those girls to this day for some reason. I'm like, that doesn't matter. Like, but that's
comical. Sorry, but anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, so he was like the first person to sit me down. It was the start of my junior year. He knew that I was going to jump pretty high, because I think right around then I was jumping around 14 feet. And he's like, hey, you know, let's sit down and let's plan out exactly how this year is going to go, and let's figure out your goals. And I just told him, I was like, I want to win state. And he's like, all right, to win state, you got to jump 15.6. And I was like, okay. You know, my PR at the time was 13.6 or 14. And for a pole vaulter, 1.5 is a lot. If you're already in that, like, over 14 range, if you're jumping like 8 or 9 feet, that's nothing. You could do that in like 2 weeks if you get lucky. But for me, that was a lot. And he sat me down, and I remember this day, he probably has it somewhere, but it was a sheet of paper, and he made me fill out all these goals and these sub goals and all this stuff. And it was crazy. I didn't think too much about it, and haven't really thought much about it until you asked me just now, but that really made me work towards something. And I was super, super focused my junior and senior year, and obviously all the way through college into now. But I think that set me along the path that I am now, because otherwise I was just a skateboarder. Like, you know, I had long hair all the way into sophomore year. And then it's not like my coach made me cut my hair, but like I cut my hair, I buckled down, I worked out, you know, I wasn't in football, so I wasn't doing football workouts anymore, but I was in the weight training class. So I was taking that pretty seriously. And yeah, I think that made a big difference for me, especially in high school.
That is always a big deal. So take me through something, because I know where you went to school. And for those that don't know where you went to school, I mean, going to Samford University and all that stuff. So how do you come? And there's always been a lot of people from Atlanta, or at least Atlanta and Georgia, coming over from Georgia over to Samford University. So how do you end up there? Where was your recruiting options when you were going? I mean, a two-time state champion out of Georgia's, especially jumping what you did, hitting, you know, 16.4, 16.8. That's pretty good. And in general, that's pretty damn good. So how do you end up at Samford? What did Rod tell you? What happened?
Yeah. So Coach Tiffin actually was the first person to reach out to me, like, seriously. Cause he saw after I jumped 15.6 junior year, he reached out to me in that summer, I think, or I don't know exactly when. But Coach Tiffin's style of recruiting, I think, is how every coach should do it, is just early establish a relationship with an athlete and let them know that you care for them to be there. It's not just like, I want you cause you're a good athlete. Like, he would call me, I swear, once a week, and we would just talk on the phone. And I was working at a gymnastics gym at the time, just at like a concession stand. And so whenever he'd call me, you know, I'd step aside, like go hide in the back, and we just talk. And it was super cool. And I got to know him really well. I was looking at Samford pretty seriously. My dad was friends with this guy named Andrew Windham. I'll plug him because he has a college recruiting business. I'm not exactly sure the name of it. His name's Andrew Windham, though. And he basically sits down with prospective athletes and basically takes them through the recruiting process, because it's kind of confusing for first time parents. You know, if your oldest kid is going through college and recruiting, it's like, how do we talk to coaches? How do we figure out scholarships, blah, blah, blah.
Well, he ended up the way that they go nowadays. It's like, that's like when I was in school to when you were in school to now what's going on. It's completely, I mean, hell, it just changed 3 years ago again. Right. That kind of stuff helps out. So anyway, sorry, go ahead,
please. So Andrew sat me down and we took a look at all the schools that gave me serious looks, which was Samford, Oral Roberts University, which Joe Dial, famous vaulter back in the day. And at the time he had Jack Witt, who was a national champion, Oral Roberts, and then Kennesaw State. Those were the three that were looking at me. Kennesaw State was like, you know, I lived in Ackworth, which is basically Kennesaw. So that was kind of home base for me.
Yep.
And basically the choices were Samford, private school, pretty expensive. Coach Tiffin offered me a half scholarship. Uh-huh. Oral Roberts, which I'll get to that in a second. And then Kennesaw State was offering me a full ride, because in Georgia you have something called the Hope Scholarship from the lottery, where basically if you don't have F's, you can get a full ride to college. So I was juggling
schools in Georgia.
Yeah, I was juggling those. So I take my official visit to Oral Roberts, right? And I liked Coach Dial. I really liked Jack. He trained there a little bit after. But Oral Roberts didn't have an outdoor track. It was kind of in the middle of nowhere.
It is.
At the time in high school, I was, you know, really, really strong in the church, that kind of thing. So I was like, Oral Roberts was a Christian school, so I was looking into that too. But I was there the same weekend they were doing this interview for all students. So incoming freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors. And they give out one scholarship a year for a full ride for the rest of your time there. And it was called the Leadership Scholarship. So they give it to one person a year. And I go through my interviews, you know, in my suit, and they ask, like, why are you a leader? You know, like, blah, 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 like all this kind of stuff. And I guess I just nailed the interviews because I actually got the scholarship. But the funny thing is, you know, Coach Tiffin, the way he recruits, he wants to know, you know, this was in November of my senior year. My dad's calling me while I'm on my trip. He's like, Coach Tiffin wants to know this week if you're going to go to Samford or go to Oral Roberts. And I just didn't have a great visit at Oral Roberts. And so I committed to Samford on my visit to Oral Roberts. And the coach there, his name was Vinny, and I'm still friends with him. I actually went to a meet in Brazil with him after college. He coaches at Liberty now. Cool guy. Yeah. I really liked him a lot, but I didn't tell him. And to this day, I haven't told him. He'd be totally fine with it if I did. But yeah, I basically talked to Coach Tiffin on the phone in my hotel room at Oral Roberts. I was like, yeah, I'll come there. And so that's kind of how it went.
You'd be able to ask Coach Tiffin then one day and be like, is that the only recruit you've ever gotten that's been on another visit? You turned around and went ahead and did that. I mean, I've known stories, and I'm actually one guy who has gotten a tattoo on a visit to a school. I did that one to my visit to University of Nebraska.
Let me show you mine.
Oh, there you go.
See my SU? Yeah, that's my Samford University one. You know, they changed the SU logo 3 days after I got that at the Olympic trials. Or it was before the Olympic trials. So I tweeted the athletic director, Martin Newton, and I was like, hey, if I make the Olympics, can we keep the SU? And he's like, sure. And then I got fourth.
So. You're like, no, there's no way. Yeah, no. When I was on my recruiting trip to Nebraska, I got a runner guy on there. And then you know, we did the exact same thing. I've got the big old Herky on my since being an Iowa guy. Hawkeye on my right hip as well. And so you had to do that kind of stuff. You had it just long enough, you know, distance runners, you can put it just below the shorts.
Yeah, so that's where I got this SU.
Yeah, because you guys have the same type. Well, some wear tights, but most wear shorts anywhere. Yeah, so that's exactly where we have it. And we had a list of criteria of, like, you had to be an All-American, you had to be All-Big Ten, you had to be a national qualifier, be in the top 10 list. You had, like, this big thing to do. And, like, okay, so we did all that kind of stuff. But it's funny that those kids that didn't get that, that got the tattoo without getting it, or any of those things, never made it.
Yeah.
Like either like they quit their sophomore year, or they got kicked off, or did something along those lines. And it was like, wow.
So yeah, that's what my dad told me, that he's got the Olympic rings on his Achilles because he was training for the Olympics as a hurdler. Ooh. And one day he told me, he was like, Trey, never get the Olympic rings before you make it to the Olympics. And I was like, all right, you're right.
We had a guy on the team, Sam Stover, like he put sub 4 on his lower back.
Oof.
And he is right there in his lower back, cool ass tattoo. And we're like, why the hell did you do it? He's like, because I'm going to break sub 4. We're like, you didn't break sub 4 yet. And we're out training in the Iowa winters, training. We went around a corner and had the ice and all that stuff, ice and snow, just after it finished up. And he went around the corner and took a massive fall and busted his hip. And never ran. I mean, he ended up running like 4:06. That was his PR coming in. He ran his junior, senior year, ran 4:06 again, but he couldn't get going because it hurt so bad. And I was like, yeah, you do that stupid stuff, it'll come back to bite you.
Yeah.
Sorry for your dad, but he said it's a great lesson. Yeah.
No. And well, of course he told me that, and I'm sitting here right now. I stick and poked a 6.00 on my hand like a month ago. that was in the middle of an ankle sprain, and I couldn't like train. So I was like, I've got to do something to stay focused, and I'm not going to fall into that trap. I'm gonna jump 6 meters. So
yeah, it's like, I mean, they do have the thing, the little tattoos you can get now that you can like put over and like rubbed out, or I don't know what it is, but some of the tattoos that like go away in like 2 or 3 weeks. You could just do that, you know, if you want to.
Yeah. This one's permanent, so I'll jump it.
You're going to have to now, because every time you look down at your hand, you're like, son of a dang it, why did I do
that? Yeah. Now I got a tattoo under this podcast so that I remember that we talked about this, and I have to jump 6 meters.
No, exactly. So are you going to turn around on the other, and then just, you know, might as well put the new Sanford logo on the other hip, just get one on both sides. But I think the trials on the other, or the, not the trials, the rings would be the better one on the other hip.
I know. Yeah. If I make the Olympics, I'll make kind of like, you know, the girls in James Bond where they wear those like guns on their hips and they have that little like holster. I'll make some sort of holster sleeve. And in the middle of my quad that I tore, this left quad, I'll put the Olympic rings or something.
So how'd you tear the quad?
I was in college. I was in warmups at Florida Relays. Mm-hmm. They played the national anthem. And so I stood around for a little while. I was the next one on the runway and didn't do any high knees, just ran down the runway and tore my quad. So you wouldn't think that a minute and a half of standing around would cool you down, but that's my excuse anyways.
No, not at all. So tell us a little bit about the collegiate success and that kind of stuff. Cause you had some incredible success. I've watched you jump many times, vault many times. And again, multiple All-American, you've had that kind of stuff. You've been fourth at the Olympic trials. Tell us some of the accomplishments that I'm passing over in college, and then go into what are you doing now vaulting wise?
Yeah. So going back to my senior year of high school, right, I broke my foot. I had that surgery and basically redshirted my whole freshman year. It was a long recovery too. I was in a non-weight bearing cast. So I had one of those little knee scooters for, 14 weeks for that. And then I was in a boot, like a walking boot, for another 12 weeks. And then I could finally start walking on my foot. So yeah, I had surgery in August, and I wasn't actually running or anything until like April. That was tough, but it was a big learning experience. And, you know, I got to travel with the team. Coach Tiffin let me travel to the SoCon championships when we won it for the first time. Mm-hmm. So I was there watching, and that was cool. Special. Got to do that. And obviously got to redshirt, which was nice, you know, as a college athlete. And looking back on it now, I wish I would have taken advantage of it and tried to fit in a master's degree, but I just took the pedal. As soon as I got that red shirt, I just took the pedal off the gas. I was like, all right, we're coasting. So I got my nutrition degree, and by my red shirt senior year, I was taking like frisbee and golf classes, you know, just to take it easy. But I'm glad I did that because it made my college more enjoyable. But I also wish I could have, you know, used my time a little more valuably, or a little bit more intelligently, and gotten like a master's or something. So so redshirted my freshman year. My second year I ended up jumping 5:30. And made it to nationals actually my freshman year, which was awesome and totally unexpected. And that unexpected is a way to describe my college career, because I unexpectedly made it to nationals my first year. Right, our first year jumping, I should say. Yes. You know, I know how I did at nationals, whatever, no big deal. Then came back my second year, and going into my outdoor conference championships, I think my PR was still only like 5:30 or something around there. 5:30, 5:32 actually. So at my conference championships, I jumped 5:50, which for those who are metrically challenged is 18 feet. Yeah. And that got me into nationals, of course. I went to nationals, but right after nationals, my PR was still only 5:50. And it put me, I think, like 32nd in the nation. And they, you know, they take top 24. This is 2016, obviously. So that's the Rio. And I'm talking to my coach Tiffin. And he's like, man, we could make Olympic trials. You just got to jump 56. That would put you 24th and you'd get in without the auto qualifier, which was 65 at the time. Yep. And I was like, all right, sweet. So then we host a little meet at Sanford with like five guys. It was me, Devin King, who was a good vaulter. My age, jumped like 570 at the time. Mondo, funny enough, was there. Okay. And some other guys. And funny story about that, it's one of the only times I've beaten Mondo, because if you don't know, Mondo slides his pole into the box. So normally, you know, the box is about a foot, 3 feet long, and your pole kind of hits the last 6 inches and then it hits the back of the box. Mondo has the strangest form of all time, because his pole slides from like 2 feet out of the box, and literally no one in the pole vault community knows how he does it. Nobody can do it. I've tried to just do it just messing around, and it's like, it just blows my mind. But our box at Sanford had a little lip on it, so if you tried to slide it, it would catch your pole. And he ended up no hiding at that meet, and he was all pissed off. And you know, he's a really fiery competitor guy, and and he was, you know, whatever, he was 14 at the time, I don't know. But yeah, so I beat him, and I can say I beat him. But I jumped 56 at that meet, which put me in. So, you know, all happy, whatever. Sanford made a big deal out of it, so that was cool.
Yep.
Literally 2 days later, and this is about 3 weeks out from trials, 2 weeks out. 2 days later, I get a call from Coach Tiff. Or no, I'm sorry. So that night, I go out partying, whatever, made it to the Olympic trials. Woo, yeah.
Gotta live it up. Gotta enjoy it.
Coach Tiffin calls me up in my hungover stupor. He's like, hey, three people jumped higher than you. Now you have to jump 65. So then I hop in a car, drive to my mom's house in Georgia, spend the night there. And then she drives me, you know, basically like asleep in the car, up to South Carolina to a meet where I ended up jumping 61, which put me over those guys, but again, doesn't get me into the trials. And then I jumped 65 on the next jump. So I went from 5:32 to 5:65, which is about a foot jump in like 2 weeks time. Or maybe a little bit more than that, maybe like 3 weeks time. But yeah, that 65 got me into Olympic trials, and unexpected in my second year of college. So it's crazy.
Holy. I mean, again, as you said, that's not supposed to happen. You're not supposed to jump that much kind of stuff. You're not supposed to drop that much time if you're running, whatever the case might be, or jump that far. That's just not supposed to. Heck, were you living on adrenaline for that, essentially, for those 2 weeks, 3 weeks? It had to be.
It was, yeah, it was wild. And I still have like Snapchat videos of me, like, you know, snapping all my friends, like, I made it. Yeah. And I'm like, just so happy to just make it into the trials. You know, 65 is the auto qualifier, but you know, there were guys jumping 70s, and of course, Sam Kendricks jumping 80, 90 stuff. So I was just happy to be there. And I'd been to Eugene twice at that point, because I went for nationals my first year, nationals for second year. So going back to Eugene was awesome. And then to do it at the Olympic trials, which is such a cool experience, was even cooler. And every year we would stay at Tracktown, or we'd stay at University Inn, which is right next to Tracktown Pizza. Oh, yeah. You know where that is? And,
I had some Tracktown Pizza.
Yep. Oh yeah. Such a cool spot. Unfortunately, the pole vaulter pizza is not very good. I think it's like all meat flavored. So I think I get like the 800 or something, the sun-dried tomato one.
It's actually pretty good. I like that 800 one. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Olympic trials was like that July 4th weekend. I go into prelims again, just happy to be there, end up basically winning prelims. Like I think Sam got me by an attempt. Obviously prelims, they stop you once they have the 12 that need to get in. But I mean, I was like clean all the way through, jumped 55 to make it into finals. And I'm just sitting there after with Coach Stephen. I was like, holy crap, I made it into finals. This is crazy. This is so cool. Like, no way. And so, yeah, 2 days later, and I'd never done a prelim finals in pole vault before. Like, it's always one meet and then you're done. So the fact that I'm jumping, you know, two times in 3 days was pretty foreign to me. But yeah, go into finals and jumping great. And I get up to, so for those who don't know, the auto qualifier was 65. That was my personal best at the time. The Olympic standard was 570. Okay. And so we get to 60. I clear 60. It puts me in, I don't know, third place or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's no point. The progression went 60, 65, 70. And Coach Tiffin, we had already decided if it goes 65 and I'm still in it, to just pass 65, go to 70. And I was like, all right. Okay. So I take a good shot at 70, not, you know, good jump, not close, whatever. Second attempt, like, haunts me to this day. I have pictures of it, a video. Mm-hmm. I'm over it. And I celebrate too early and brush it off with my chest. And Brian Yokoyama, who was, who's still now the head of the pole vault chair for USATF, he came up to me after and he goes, Trey, I don't know you, but everyone in those stands, their buttholes were clenched that whole meet, because they didn't think me, the nobody from Sanford, was going to make it on the Olympic team. It was crazy. Yeah. But yeah, so missed second attempt, missed third attempt. And when I missed third attempt, Logan Cunningham made it off of attempts when I missed that 70, because he was out at 65. He already had the standard or something like that. Yeah. I forget exactly when, but his coach, Brooklyn Deckler. Yeah. I think she screamed at the top of her lungs and I thought it was my mom. And so I was like, did she really think I made that? Like, but I remember that scream and just being like heartbroken. But immediately after, I was still just on top of the world, because I was like, this was just so unexpected to finish fourth, you know?
I mean, golly, that's an incredible thing. And you're right. I mean, I hate to say it. I hate to be the guy to say it. And I think we're all thinking at the same time. We've seen multiple times where somebody's celebrating 25 meters out or 10 meters out or starting to go across the line or right before that time. And all of a sudden they have no idea what's going on before or going on behind them. And all of a sudden, bam, they get caught at the line and they lose that state title or they lose that conference championship in a college. We've seen it before. Like, yes. And all of a sudden, boom, you're like, yeah, you celebrated too early and you had it. And it was probably a beautiful thing. But again, just like the tattoo that you've essentially put on yourself with the 6 meters, like, you're gonna be like, man, I got this. I'm going to get this, because I'm not gonna let that sit down and be the guy that hit my chest and boom, I fell over. And excuse me, boom, I didn't make it. Like, I'm definitely gonna make it. You can tell that. So what do you? Yeah. So you're out in, am I correct in this? You're out in Arizona right now, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So what are you doing out in Arizona?
So my senior year, I started dating Courtney Ross, my now wife. After Olympic trials, that's how she knew me, was from the Olympic. She was sitting in the stands, and then we got in touch over Instagram. She messaged me. She's like, hey, you're kind of cute. And I was like, you know, intoxicated. Yeah, she loves telling that story, but she messaged me and I messaged her and we got back and forth. She was living out in San Diego training at the Chula Vista Elite Training Center in San Diego. She went to Oregon and then transferred to San Diego State. Wasn't a great jumper in college, but you know, her PR now is 463. She's gunning for the Olympics as well. She's, you know, top five in the US. So right now. So we started dating my junior year, redshirt junior year. Yep. And so I knew going into senior year, I was either gonna move out to Chula Vista. And I had already talked to the coach. I was going to have a spot there, get paid to live there, you know, train, all that for free. Or I also, at that time, started to make friends with these hooligans, basically my best friends here in Arizona, Nathan Hyatt and Garrett Starkey. And basically this whole group of pole vaulters that we called Solar Powered Manweather. They were just the group of friends on Instagram. And we had like a funny little Instagram page. We posted videos of each other and stuff. And we had a Solar Power Manweather week where we came out here to Dean Starkey's house, who Dean Starkey, for those who don't know, was a really good American vaulter back in the day, got third at the 97 World Championships. At that week, I decided, I was like, I'm not going to go to Chula Vista. You know, I'm going to come here with my friends, live out here, train out here, even though it's more financially difficult, right? Like, you know, got to live in an apartment, got to get a job, all that kind of stuff. And instead, it would have just been me and Courtney together at Chula Vista. We'd have been training under a good coach. Chris Mack is there, but yes. I would have had no training partners, no friends. And you know, it's something that I think back to like, oh man, it'd be so easy financially to do all that. But I'm so glad that I did this because coming out here, I've made amazing friends. Courtney and I now own a house. Uh-huh. We live with a bunch of vaulters that are training for the Olympics as well. We have just a house full of vaulters. And so here I am coaching at Arizona Pole Vault Academy is what Dean Starkey runs at, in his house or in his backyard, basically. And it's a big club. I mean, like we've got 80 something kids signed up. Now we have an Olympic weightlifting set up in this giant facility. So this is forming to be my career going forward is a coach. And and hopefully I can bolster my coaching credentials by making the Olympics, you know, working as a professional vaulter through my 30s. And, you know, that's kind of the dream now.
I think getting into coaching, it's the craziest thing in the world. You can make more money probably doing what you're doing right now. Well, maybe not more money, but if you do it as well as you guys are, there might be a little more in there. You never know. But coaching, there's some incredible things about it. I think we'd all tell you that there's a lot of ups, there's a lot of downs, but at the same time, man, when you're actually able to help a kid achieve some things, there's nothing more special than that kind of thing, especially when you have a kid or a coach like Rod Tiffin that is an incredible mentor. And that kind of way of saying like, dude, this is, you're right. This is how a college coach should recruit. This is because props to coach. We didn't say this earlier, but props to Coach Tiffin. And you probably thought about this before, maybe if you haven't, I apologize, but there's a lot of coaches that even though you've broken the foot and then they know about you breaking the foot, will be like, you know what, that scholarship, we kind of need that back. Cause you don't know what's going to happen after that. So big props to him for sticking with you.
Yeah. And I can't talk enough about Coach Tiffin. Coach Moffitt, my high school coach, was so influential in my life and really all three of my coaches, you know, moving forward, Coach Moffitt in high school, Coach Tiffin in college, and now Coach Starkey. They've all had like such lasting impacts on me. I think Coach Tiffin probably the most because that was definitely some of my most formative years in college. And and I have so many stories to tell about Coach Tiffin, but probably my favorite one was we were at a meet at South Alabama and somehow he found out that once we got home from the meet, everybody was going to this club and I was not the person in charge of this. It was for one of the guys on the team's birthday, but he comes up to me because I was the like unsung leader of the team. And he poked me in the chest so hard that it like blew me back. And he was like, if anyone gets in trouble, if anyone gets hurt, you're to blame. And I was like, oh, and that's when I knew like he put this like huge like crown of responsibility on me. And he did that from like seriously my first time there, like even when I was a redshirt freshman and was not, you know, even a part of the team basically. Yep. He still was like investing in me, and all my teammates like to joke about it, but I was kind of like the golden child. You know, like I was almost part of the coaching staff. I would go hang out in Coach Tiffin's office, you know, in between classes, and you know, we were just buds, and it was really cool. And I really enjoy that part of my time at Samford. I think a lot of people ask me like what I enjoyed most about Samford. And obviously it was my teammates, but above all, it was Coach Tiffin and his, just his like tutelage basically.
That's the thing that I think actually you hit on something real quick before we go into a couple other things. You know, sometimes people look at it and go, oh, it's favoritism. And it's favoritism, whatever. But at the same time, like you wanted to go do that. And by sitting there talking to coach and talking to the coaches in there, you actually learned and you were getting another education that those kids weren't getting, that weren't going in to talk to them and weren't doing that kind of stuff. And I've never seen favoritism. When I went to Iowa, I had the same thing where the coach looked at me and said, man, that kid's got bigger balls than everybody else here. And I was like, oh crap, I'm a freshman that just ran a 3K. Like, and it was amazing. But because of what I did that day, that's exactly what he told a couple people. And the weight of the program after that was put on my shoulders. Exactly. Yeah. Same type of thing. Like, okay, boom. And it wasn't a favorite. It was who's going to show up and run. But yet again, when we didn't run well, I remember one of our Big Ten championships, when the team didn't run well, he looked at me and he goes, well, Matt, good to let you know that you let the alumni, the fan base, and everybody else down. And I was like, I mean, yeah, congratulations. You want to be a favorite or favoritism? No, no, no. The weight that comes with that sometimes is astronomical. And as you said, if one person got injured or arrested or sick, whatever the case might be, going out, like I wouldn't even want to know what would have happened when Tiffin would have come down after you with real facts. Yeah. That would have been ugly.
So, but you said right now you're working with, you know, you're working with coach, you're working at the Arizona Pole Vaults Academy. And so what do you guys, and you've got, yes, a whole bunch of vaulters living at the house with you. But at the same time, like, how are you guys using just the, is the Pole Vault Academy, is that where all the money's coming from? Like, how are you sustaining yourself? Because I know one thing is being a professional athlete, even some of the best in the country here in the U.S. aren't making a ton of money to be able to do what they're doing. So how do you maintain what you're doing?
Yeah, I think coming out of college, I knew immediately, I told everybody I was friends with, I was like, I'm ready to embrace the grind, meaning like, yep, I don't mind making like next to nothing. Mm-hmm. If it means that I can continue to train and do what I love, and that being pole vaulting. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wasn't going to make like buku bucks coming out of college. I wasn't like, you know, Trayvon Bromell signing a big old deal with Nike or Christian Coleman. You know, I hadn't won nationals or anything, but so yeah, I moved out to Arizona. I immediately got a job at an old folks home bartending, which was great. It sucked because I couldn't make tips, because according, you know, to the law, you're not allowed to make tips at old folks homes because you can really take advantage of them. You know, they'll tip you all of their life savings if they really love you, because they're, unfortunately, their kids don't come and see them. Yep. But I did that for about a year and a half, bartended there. Mm-hmm. I luckily got in touch with a guy named Richard McBee, who owns a company in Birmingham called Move Daddy, and it's a moving company. And I got in touch with him through the weirdest way. It was through my massage therapist, Matt, and he was friends with Richard, and somehow we got in touch. I went to lunch with Richard, and Richard was really into cycling. Like, he was a professional cyclist and had sponsored cyclists, and he's like, hey, I know pole vaulting is such an obscure sport, like, I want to help you out. And he basically just, charitable donation, would give me $500 a month for 2 years, which was awesome. I mean, it was just a free,
depending on what you're doing.
Yeah, it did. And so I was making about $1,000 from the bartending a month, because I was doing that about 3 days a week for like 4 hour shifts, and getting that money from Richard. And then coaching at the time, I was only making like $500 coaching. So I was making like, you know, $2,000 a month, basically, like surviving. And, the situation has changed slightly. Like, I don't make any more money, but now I'm not bartending. I'm only coaching and doing the nutrition stuff, doing nutrition counseling. So I make about $1,600 coaching, extra money on the side with the nutrition stuff. Unfortunately, the sponsorship with Move Daddy ended because it was just a 2 year thing, and they helped me. I mean, they gave me $12,000 over 2 years.
That's
so,
appreciative.
You know,
no doubt.
Yeah, tax free. And so, super happy for that. And the coaching is growing. So, you know, slowly making more and more money. I'm getting placed more responsibility right now. I'm the facility manager, in quotations. Mm-hmm. So, like, I kind of take care of facility, I order poles, take care of stuff, like all that kind of stuff. So that's getting big. And, you know, my coach and my boss, Dean Starkey, he wants this AZPVA where we coach at to be this thing where me, the other coaches, Nate and Garrett, who are also training, he wants it to be where we're making, you know, close to six figures, you know, just coaching. Obviously, he wants us to experience what he experienced in the 90s, going over to Europe, going to meets, absolutely, going to world championships and stuff. But I'm just happy that I'm doing a job that is completely understanding of my schedule and of my like time as an athlete. Because like, I'm going to Texas this weekend for a meet. You know, normally if it was any other job, I'd have to call out and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, hey, you know, no practice this Saturday. The coaches are going to compete, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And actually the kids are probably like, okay, dude, that's awesome. We understand. Like, we want to vault. But at the same time, like, dude, our coaches are going to go compete at some big time meets. Like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
So you mentioned one of the things, well, nutritionist on the side, like, are you a nutritionist? Cause back at Sanford, would you get the degree, but like, what are you doing with that?
Yeah. Oh, before we get into that, one more sponsor, please. That's been helping me was a company here in Phoenix called Midwestern Meats. It's a butcher shop. They're both of their kids, have come through AZPVA. One of them is at Mississippi State or Ole Miss right now, Samara McConnell. She's jumping out of her mind. Yep. I coached her for a while. And then their son, Kellen, is still in the club, but they own this butcher shop, and they basically sponsor us for like $150 worth of food a month. And they just basically give it to us. So I go in, pick up a bunch of meat, throw it in my freezer. And so it's just been a really good, like, you know, that's just $150 saved, you know. So they've been a good sponsor as well.
Food too. I mean, you're talking like straight from the butcher. I mean, that, come on, that's not, there's nothing much better right there.
Yeah, it's awesome to go in and pick out everything I want and then ring up at the register, $0. And I'm like, thanks. And then just pop out of there. So that's been cool. But yeah, so with the nutrition stuff, you know, I've got my degree from Samford in nutrition with a emphasis on sports nutrition. And, you know, my time in Samford, I spent a lot of time researching nutrition, because the reason I chose that as a major is I was like, I want something that'll make me better as an athlete. I don't want to be a psychology major or something boring like that. In my eyes, I wanted something that benefited me immediately as an athlete. And so nutrition made the most sense. And so now kind of what I do is through AZPVA, you know, we have tons of kids here. I'll have a kid say, hey, you know, I don't really know much about nutrition. I want to eat better. And so I put together this program where I work one-on-one with a kid. We have weekly meetings, either in person. Most of them are over the phone, because I've worked with kids in Colorado and Idaho and all places. I've actually worked with elite athletes. Some of the guys that I compete against, I call once a week and we talk about their nutrition, and I get them started with plans and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like this education program / food therapist / accountability partner, mm-hmm. I would say. And it's this program I do, and it's run through AZPVA. So I guess I'll give you the link that you can put up to the AZP website. It's got all the information on the program. Yep. It's really good for, I think, especially high school athletes that just don't really know much about food or how to eat as an elite athlete. And I kind of give you the ropes, and through my own experiences, I can give a very detailed explanation of how things work versus, mm-hmm. you know, just some random sports nutrition guy who doesn't know like pole vaulting specifics or exactly the training that you're doing, all that kind of stuff. I take all that into account, and I've had some pretty good success, you know, with the high school athletes. And then, you know, I work with adults too. I'm working with my high school coach, Coach Moffitt, right now to help him lose weight. And he's actually the program is a 3-month program. He's done it 3 times now. So we talk about once a week for every week. So
No, that's incredible. Yeah, we'll definitely put the link up in the bio, of course, and we'll have you plug it here and again in a second. So a couple things that we always ask on the podcast, no matter what it was, no matter what we're doing, you're a collegiate athlete. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't matter in the South, you know, in the SoCon or not, you were a collegiate athlete. You've been to numerous meets along that kind of stuff. What is a way that collegiate track and field can actually become more exciting and more attractive to the fans? Because unless you're in it, and the one thing we've always found is unless you're in it, like you're in, you know, the AZPA, excuse me, I tried to roll it off my tongue for the first time and I needed to slow down for a sec, but you're in it. Okay. So you're going to be in there. You're going to go to vaults. You're going to go to meets and do that kind of stuff. But a lot of people, we find that, you know, you're going to go back. You go back for a Samford basketball game. You go back for a Samford football game. But a lot of people aren't going to go back for the Samford meet, the track and field meet. Or, you know, Iowa was the same way. You'll go back for the Iowa, the basketball game and the football game. But, oh, there's a track and field meet. Well, wait, there's a track and field meet? Like, oh, well, I didn't know that. So why would I have gone back? Like, how do we make a collegiate meet more exciting that we actually get more fans in there? Is there a way? Have you ever thought about this kind of thing?
I think the generic answer, and it's such a cheap answer, is like getting the fans involved, having them do the events, having, you know, like just a random person run the 100 next to all the collegiate athletes and see them get blown out of the water. You know, it's a fun idea, but I don't think it's a good idea necessarily. You know, you could have someone go try pole vault and they're like, well, that's really hard. But like that gets one person interested. It doesn't get a large swath of people interested in the events that you're doing. I also don't think the answer is cutting events. You know, like some people will say, like, you know, like they're trying to cut the triple jump and some of the longer distance events. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the answer either. Something I've discussed on my own podcast, which I'm not going to plug it because we talk about it's just me and my friends talking shit, basically. So don't go listen to that. But something we talked about was like, not necessarily collegiately, but post-collegiately, like making state teams. So like I could be representing Arizona at a Drake Relays, let's say, and versus Mondo or what he was, it was Sam, who would represent Mississippi or something like that. But that's not a good idea either, because you got to represent Nike and all this weird stuff like that. So it's a really tough question, especially when you talk about collegiate stuff. I think the answer is just investing more money in promotion and sort of like, you know how like basketball games will have like the fan comes out and shoots the free throw or something like that. It's got to be something like, I don't know, it sounds so stupid, but like popcorn night or hot dog night, or like something that Birmingham, the Barons do, is like the dog night. Like they have the bark in the park,
I think it is.
Bark in the park. Yeah. Yep. So like, that's really cool. You could do something like that at the track meet. I think there's definitely something that could be said about the scheduling of track meets, like doing more events, more fast paced. And also like what one big thing in the field events, at least like throws, jumps and pole vault, is no one knows what the height is.
Nope.
Sometimes no one knows what attempt it is. So like nobody knows what's going on. You just see a guy run down the runway, jump into the sand, and then that's it. You don't know how far he jumped because the officials like whisper it, you know. I don't know. There's a lot of minuscule little things like that. You can have a head official, like in a NFL game, that announces things. So like over the intercom, even though it might seem like a lot of like barking over the intercom, so-and-so long jump 795 world lead, blah, blah, blah. Everybody gets excited for that, you know? Pole vault and long jump and throws do a good job of the clap. You know, when I was in Oregon and they were running the mile and they had that steady clap going, oh, that was so cool. So
that just gives you shivers, doesn't it? It's just like, oh my goodness. Yep.
Especially on that back stretch, man, it's so loud. So
that's brilliant.
Stuff like that. You know, I've always said with pole vault, why is there not just like a wooden box that has three red flags and it signifies what attempt everyone is attempting? You know what I mean? Like, cause my mom from the stands is like, is it first attempt or is it second attempt? Like she never knows. And you know, she doesn't know what height it is unless they like turn the board around. So I don't know. I'm just like venting about all the problems, not really coming up with many solutions, but I don't think it's cutting events. I think it's more in promoting. I mean, I see the way that Samford basketball promotes and it's so creative, right? Like it seems like basketball social media guys have got it figured out. UAB, I think it's basketball. I even going to Samford, I would see their stuff. And I was like, I never go to a UAB basketball game, but I would at least see their stuff. So, you know, they usually give the track teams like some social media intern, but, if we really want to invest in it, it would be, you know, finding some money to put into a real social media person to come up with some creative ideas to get at least more butts in the seat.
You're right there. I mean, that's one of the biggest things we've actually talked about, is making sure that we had, how do you get more butts in the seats? How do you get a promotion going and that kind of thing? How do you get more people going? You know, do you bring the public in, have them sit down and have them maybe do the vault, or have them maybe do 100 meters, or, you know, do you bring in the high school 4x1 and do that in the middle, or do you do like the fastest kid in Birmingham or the fastest kid in Milwaukee or Atlanta, and you get like, you know, 8 kids or you get 16 kids lined up and you run 2 heats and then whoever wins, and then boom, you go. Like getting more fan interaction, because you actually hit on a point with promotion of meets. You know, most of the time, and you're right, Samford did it, UAB's, you know, guilty of it too. Bradley was guilty of it too. It's not that they don't want to be promoted, it's that they don't have the resources to promote the meet sometimes. And so you as a coach, that's your job, is to promote the meet as best you can and to get that out in the community. And even when you tell the community, then hopefully you get some guys and some people to do some incredible jobs promoting the meets. But man, it's not easy. And so I think there's 100 different ways. I think you're right. Cutting events isn't the smartest thing to do it, especially with the participation numbers that we have. But at the same time, can you get things faster? Can you get the public more informed? And can they understand, you know, the ways that things are? So let me go ahead. Yeah, please.
Yeah. So an idea I had, and I don't know if this is NCAA compliant, like, let's say there's a home meet at Samford, and, you know, normally I'd have like 4 of my friends, you know, from just college come watch me. Mm-hmm. What if there was a way that Samford track would say, if Trey Oates jumps 19 feet at the home meet tonight, whoever is there gets, you know, full moon barbecue or whatever, like, you know, a sandwich or something like that, that style of promotion. Like, I know they do that at like professional football games, right? Like if they score a touchdown in the third inning, everybody gets free Taco Bell, like something like that at least gets people there and buying tickets. I know you don't buy tickets to a track meet, but like, you know, coming to the track meet. I don't know if that's NCAA compliant, but it's an idea.
No, actually, I like the idea. It might be compliance. It might work, but the better thing, I think you just take your name out of it and say, if anybody at the Sanford Invitational jumps over 19 meters, jumps 19 meters, then, you know, then everybody in the stands gets, you know, a full moon barbecue ticket, you know, for a free meal or something like that, instead of using your name, because then you can quickly go in and go, oh, we can rig this because if this kid doesn't get it and I don't get it and all that stuff. But if you go, the whole meet does it, whoever breaks 4 minutes in the mile, okay, yeah, then the whole stadium gets a free pizza. Everybody gets pizza, you know, something like that. Yeah, and that could be fun. And again, you're like hot dog night, dog night. Hey, everybody comes in, somebody does this, free hot dogs for everybody, and then have the, you know, coaches or somebody out cooking hot dogs in the back, and everybody's getting a hot dog when they're walking out. Especially for a college kid, that could be fun. Remember the Jim Duncan Invitational at Drake in Des Moines? It's the warm-up for the Drake Relays. They actually had, I don't think they're supposed to, but they're right outside of what was the third turn, the third stretch in Drake before they actually redid the whole thing, the home stretch, the home turn at Drake. There was about a 50-meter straightaway, but all the fraternities and sororities were out there. And we're pretty sure we were running the meet. There was enough kegs going on around the outside, but the place was loud and the corner was awesome. And I'm like, you know what? That's incredible, because the British Olympic trials and the 10K, they just had, when they had those things, there is a beer tent that you have to run through every single time. And the fans are lined with it. I'm like, you know what? That is awesome. I'm not going to say we should bring alcohol and betting into collegiate sports. I'm not for that. But at the same time, the atmosphere for the pro sport world is pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure.
So last question before we let you go here, because I know you got to rock and roll. You just got done working. You need to eat some dinner, do that kind of stuff, get some of that free meat and all that kind of jazz. Is there a way that the sport of track and field can actually, like, can you highlight pro vaulting right now? Is something like Sandy Moores did in her backyard, you know, I think, which is an incredible thing to put that on. Is that the kind of thing that vaulting needs to do to get a bigger following? Or is it with these clubs where, I mean, you said 81 people. I know Chris Spear over here, I don't know how many he has, but I think he's probably got 30 or 40 kids in his club. And Chris, I apologize if you're listening, you might have more and I don't know it. But like, is that kind of the best way to do it through clubs? Like, how is the best way to get pole vaulting more of an audience? Because it definitely is a niche. It's not like running the miles, not like going to go run 100 meters. You know, the field events are niche type of things. So how do you do that?
Yeah. Speaking to pole vault, specifically, I mean, pole vault does a really good job, I think, of the street vaults. You know, if you've ever been to one of those are amazing. Even if those, it's just awesome high school kids jumping, you know, the parents, if a parent goes to one street meet, they're invested for their kid's entire high school experience. And hopefully they want to get their kid to college, and then now they're invested in the college, and now you got more butts in the seat, that kind of thing. Although it's just parents, you know, it's still fans. I think Pobl does a really good job with the street meets. they're kind of fights, no. The street meets. Drake does the mall vault. I think that's great.
That's pretty cool.
One thing that I've talked with this coach, Bronco, who has a podcast called Apex Vaulting Podcast, he's got a pretty good idea. And it might seem controversial, but like, I think that pole vaulting specifically needs to move further away from USATF style meets for high school. Like, nobody goes to those USATF regional meets as a fan. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're a high school kid going to USATF regionals in order to qualify for USATF nationals, it's just a meet. Like, nobody's there except for the parents. Nobody's watching it. It would take a lot of organization, and pole vault almost did this with something called American Pole Vault Association or something like that. It was put on by these guys who had a lot of money and were invested in pole vault. It kind of fell on its face a little bit, but it was the right idea of the clubs need to organize their own USATF style season, almost like having like competitions between clubs, putting on a street vault and saying, all the clubs around, you know, bring your kids. Valter Magazine is actually a club in California who's doing a really good job of that. They're putting on meets left and right, you know, besides COVID, and in California, they're still putting on meets besides, you know, they're getting all these city ordinances. But I think everything's sort of clearing up in that sense. And I think if they can continue to do that, and AZPBA puts on meets, like we're right now, I'm in the process of building a runway. I actually got the plans from Sandy Morris's dad, Harry, to build their same runway. Mm-hmm. We're going to take our pit to, like, you know, a horse arena, just like they do the Reno Pole Vault Summit, and put on something like that, and just do multiple of those, and have, you know, because in Arizona, at least, there's no indoor season. The outdoor season is like from March until April. It's like so short. And for the kids who aren't in club, there's just not this big buy-in to track and field. And there's no buy-in from the parents. And then there's no buy-in from the friends of the competitors who would be the potential fans. So I think having these, I don't even know what you call them, but just away from this like USATF style thing that we're doing. I'm not saying that USATF is bad. I just don't think it's the format to grow the sport and pole vault in specific. When you talk about running stuff that needs a track, that's a whole different conversation. But pole vault, you can, with a little bit of time and effort, you can move pole vault anywhere and you can make it as big as you want. So I just think it takes some investors and some time. We almost did a vault at a Phoenix Suns game in halftime, like out, not in the court, but like outside of the arena. We almost put together a pole vault competition of just elite athletes, and it was just going to be like an exhibition type thing, but we would have gotten everyone coming to that Phoenix Suns game would have walked past that and at least seen it and watched it. And then, you know, you get maybe 50 kids interested in it, and then they try their local club, and then we're boosting the numbers of track and field athletes that way. I think that's the start. And then once you get there, then you can start talking about making regional teams and all that kind of stuff. So
I tell you one thing that I talked with Brian Fetzer a little bit and Paul Doyle over at Doyle Management. And we talked a little bit about it. And COVID hit and things didn't happen. It kind of slowed down. And then again, they started the ATL, the American Track League, and they did an incredible job with that. But one thing we actually talked about here in Birmingham, and Chris knew about this as well, was that we were we talked about doing, and we had clearance from the Barons and Good People Brewing Company to do the street vault right in front in between that street right now. Oh yeah. You get people walking out, you get that right there. We're going to do a shot put in the parking lot of Good People because they've got that gravel lot right there where they put the food trucks, and then do a mile that would essentially finish right at the box office for the Barons. And you could actually run it on the other side of First Avenue North, come down 18th, come back down First Avenue South. And boom, it was like within 10 meters of a mile, 15 meters of a mile. It was like boom, boom, set up. And then all of a sudden COVID hit and we've had to hold the brakes on everything. But again, you talk about a quick little three meet, you know, IAAF certified type of thing, USATF certified. You get the number of meets, the events that you need. You get to put the shot put on, so you get some best shot putters. You get the vaulters coming in, so you get the world's best. And the best part is you could do two things. We were thinking about doing on a Thirsty Thursday as well. So you could start the thing about 4 or 5. Because by the time somebody gets out at 7 or 8 o'clock, or about 8 o'clock when that game gets over, even start the thing at 5 o'clock, maybe 6, by the time they get to there we go, a little bit.
I can hear you.
There we go. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Happened. I don't know what it is. But by the time that we actually get to the, you know, big heights, there we go. Sorry, a little technical difficulties with my headphones. Then you actually have people coming out at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. You're under the lights. You got the music going. And, man, you'd have one hell of an environment. No questions about it. And I know they talk about doing that in a lot of different cities, too. So hopefully that kind of stuff gets really rocking and rolling.
I think the best way to think about it is track and field has to be like the suckerfish on the side of a shark. Like, we have to, like, combine ourselves with these bigger sports, even if it's, you know, Barons baseball. Yeah, I used to work as a bartender at Barons Field, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, that would be so cool to have pole vault running events, maybe a long jump pit set up. I think that's if you want to get athletes to make money, like professional athletes to make money, which then in turn gets people interested in even becoming a professional athlete in track and field, you've got to at least show them that it's like in the same, for lack of a better word, ballpark of those big sports, because it is like those big sports. It's just nobody realizes it because, like you said at the beginning of this, nobody comes to watch it. So yeah.
100%. Trey, I know you got to rock and roll. I truly appreciate you taking the time to join me, I would normally say us, but to join me on the Off Track podcast. I know you got some crazy stuff going on and doing some incredible things right now. So from all of us, best of luck. Keep it rocking and rolling. It's great to see you doing that kind of stuff. And we look forward to next time you're making that Olympic jump. You don't bump that bar a little bit and you actually get over that 6 meters and then like, boom, there you go. So I appreciate you again. We'll put the link up to the AZPBA on the website. Make sure that you take a look at some nutrition stuff. Make sure you guys look at what he's doing and his club is doing out there. They're doing some incredible things that help promote the sport. So no doubt about it. Thanks, Trey.
For sure, man. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Oh, man. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was awesome. It was great to talk to Trey, be able to hear exactly what he's doing. I really enjoyed hearing about his time at Samford and how much time Coach Tiffin put into him and the importance it was for him to be the first phone call that Coach Tiffin had made, and the fact of, you know, just the personality and the relationship that Coach had with Trey Fit. That's one thing I think we forget a lot about when we're out in the coaching world, is that fit of that athlete-coach relationship and how absolutely important it is. Also, his story on, you know, being a favorite. A lot of times I think we hear favorites and people are like, oh my goodness, they're a favorite, and be like, yeah, but sometimes if you're favorites, the pressure that comes with being a favorite, as you could tell, is a little more than you think is actually in the kitchen. So if you can stand the fire in the kitchen, go ahead and be a favorite and do everything you got to do. But it was incredible to hear how Trey actually dealt with that and work on that kind of stuff. And also, I really appreciate Trey's candidness on how, you know, how tough it is right now for him and his wife and the group of pole vaulters that are out living out there, how they're truly making ends meet, you know, by doing a lot of odd jobs and doing a lot of things to help themselves survive. No questions about it, though. If you can sit back and relax and go help support him, the Arizona Pole Vault Academy, he's got a little nutrition program out there. Go check it out. So this one was incredible to have Trey on. As I said, I was ecstatic to have a pole vaulter on, and especially somebody at the high level of Trey Oates. No questions about it. We truly appreciate him being here. And we thank you as well for tuning in, for sharing, for liking. Please, as I said, like is always the best form, of advertisement is always word of mouth. No questions about it. So if you can share us, like us, rate us on iTunes, share us on Spotify, whatever the case you may be. We truly appreciate you doing an incredible job with us and rocking with us every single week. We look forward to doing another one even better than this one and everyone before that next week. So we look forward to talking to you soon. Happy Easter.